Then the wind dies down and the trees go silent. They leave a hollowness inside me, a yearning to listen to their music for hours and days and years. I've never heard anything so beautiful or strange. Amelia, play for them, Amelia. Is it the trees talking? Play for who? Then I laugh uneasily at my own ridiculous imagination. Trees don't talk. Of course, they aren't supposed to make music either. And before I half know what I'm doing, I've taken my flute from its case. I feel like I'm trapped in a spell, my brain all fogged up. What should I play? I whisper. The trees don't answer, but the wind blows again, harder this time, and the leaves sing in response. Listening very close, I can pick out a melody, so soft and faint I might be imagining it. It's a spell I know well, Pachelbel's Canon, a summoning spell, meant to move an object from one place to another. But what would trees need to summon? After a moment of hesitation, I play along. The notes rise from my flute in glowing yellow streamers, coiling and fading. Slow and measured, the same 8 notes repeating over and over, a melody with no clear end. Is it my imagination, or are the trees echoing the notes back to me, harmonizing with my flute? My arms break out in goosebumps. When the wind dies down and the trees fall silent, I hold the last note of the spell, then lower my flute. The air around me feels charged and tight. But as the music fades, everything relaxes, until it seems it was all just my mind playing tricks. I pack up my flute and hurry to the front of the school. I'm probably not supposed to be back here, and I definitely don't want to start my year at Mistwick with detention, if they even have detention. I'm beginning to think this place will be nothing like my old school. Back in front of Harmony Hall, I see I've returned just in time. The other students are heading in, with Miss March waving them through the main doors. I jog up and slip in line behind Amari. "Come in, come in," Miss March says. "Check in with Miss Nurani on your left, then head through the back door to dinner. Hurry now." We walk into a grand foyer with wood floors and a huge fireplace against the back wall, surrounded by couches and tables, all in warm tones of red and brown and deep purple. Iron chandeliers hang above, and the columns supporting the high ceiling are carved like real trees. In one corner sits a huge, gleaming grand piano. And even though I'm not great at piano, I still sigh with awe when I see it. Above us, 3 inner balconies overlook the common area. The entire front wall of the hall is made of huge windows, giving incredible views of the lake and mountains. Standing on a large rug with music notes all over it, I turn a full circle and take it all in, mouth gaping. I listen to the sounds of the students' shoes squeaking on the floor, their soft conversations, and from one of the upper floors, the low tone of a cello. Just as I expected. Perfect acoustics. I bet every room in this school has perfect acoustics, bouncing sound around until it's as pure and sweet as it can be. "Ahem," says a voice. "Name?" I turn around, startled, to see everyone else has finished checking in. I recognize the woman, Miss Nurani, from my auditions. She's the one who smiled at me. Until I ruined everything. For a moment, it all rushes back. The bungled spell, the mustache man staring angrily at his sudden bounty of facial hair, the poor little tree twisting sideways. And I wonder, what did the maestros see in me? What about me made them overlook the disastrous audition? The questions have been buzzing in my mind ever since I got the acceptance letter, but I haven't had the guts to really think about them. I almost ask Miss Nurani, but then my courage fails. She doesn't seem to recognize me. But when I tell her my name, she gives me a startled look.
"Did you say Amelia Jones?"
"I have my letter." The paper is soft and wrinkled from me unfolding it so much, as in 12 times a day and a couple times at night, when I woke up thinking it must all be a dream. She takes the acceptance letter and scans it, her brow furrowing.
She looks at me again, then down at the papers on her desk. My stomach starts to sink. She purses her lips, then turns and beckons to Miss March.
Take the others on to dinner, she whispers. I'll look after this one.
Uh-oh. Something is wrong. Miss March rounds up the rest of the group and leads them to an open set of doors, through which I can smell the unmistakable aroma of pizza. But my hunger seems to have vanished. I don't think I could eat so much as a pepperoni. Miss Nurani picks up a viola, tucks it under her chin, and plays a quick summoning spell that I don't recognize. Then, giving me a tired look, she says,
Follow me, dear, and we'll sort this out.
I nod woodenly. Miss Nurani leads me through a door and down a hallway, then up a shining spiral staircase. My steps get heavier and heavier. My flute feels like it weighs a ton. I can't even begin to wonder what the problem is, because if I do, I think I might throw up. So instead, I just watch my feet. We stop in front of a large door on one of the inner balconies and find three more maestros waiting there. I recognize them all from my audition. The mustache man, a tall, skinny man, and a short, muscular woman with braided hair.
Miss Nurani, we are all exhausted from chasing new students,
says the skinny one.
I hope this is important. Yes, if you saw the chaos, I almost didn't hear your summoning spell,
says the lady with the braids in a strong accent. German, maybe?
What's wrong?
Miss Nurani puts her hand on my shoulder. I'm sorry for pulling you all away at such a busy time, she says. But I wanted you to meet Amelia Jones. The three maestros stare.
Amelia Jones?
Echoes the skinny one.
Amelia Jones.
Why is he saying it like that? I ask Miss Nurani. What's wrong with being Amelia Jones? Oh no. Did Gran change her mind? Did she call the school and demand that I be sent home?
Amelia, Miss Nurani says. These are the deans of Mistwick.
She introduces them. The skinny one is Mr. Walters, maestro of brass. The German one is Miss Becker, maestro of percussion. And the mustache man, his facial hair a lot shorter than it was last time I saw him, is Mr. Pinwhistle, maestro of woodwinds. Wonderful. He would be in charge of flutes.
I, of course, am maestro of strings, she adds. Now, why don't we all go into the office and see what the headmaestro has to say?
Day one, and I'm already being sent to the principal's office. Miss Nurani gestures to the big door behind us. The others nod and head toward it. None of them look annoyed anymore that they were called away. Worse, they look grim, like my arrival is the worst news they've had all week. What is going on? The door takes us up another staircase to a big office. A window on the back wall overlooks the forest beyond, where I played my flute earlier. It's mostly dark now, and I hear a strange, musical humming that I can't trace to any source. At the center of the room is a desk lit by a stained glass lamp, and behind it sits the most elegant woman I've ever seen. She has warm brown skin and a heart-shaped face. Her hair is twisted in a tall swoop like a piece of art. She's working at a computer, the blue light of the screen reflecting on her glasses, and there is a cello propped behind her. She looks up as we enter, taking off the glasses and blinking at me, then at Miss Nurani. Something jumps from her lap, a sleek spotted cat with yellow eyes. It runs around the desk and rubs against my legs. I realize it's the cat who's humming, repeating a low, simple melody deep in its throat. Faint wisps of gold magic curl around its whiskers and then fade away. A music cat. I've only ever read about the rare species, which, like Jenkins's parrot, is one of the few types of animals capable of working magic. Leaning down to pet the cat, I hear a cough from Miss Nurani, who shakes her head at me.
Better not, she says. Wink tends to purr when you pet him, and his purring has a rather somnolent effect.
She pauses, then adds,
It makes you fall asleep.
Oh. I withdraw my hand,
and settle for watching the Music Hat as he slithers between my legs and moves on to rub on Mr. Pinwhistle, who grumbles irritably. The woman at the desk ignores all of this, instead asking, "What's wrong, Lila?" "A bit of confusion, Mrs. LaRue." Miss Nurani hands her my acceptance letter. I stand very still while Euphonia LaRue, headmaestro of the Mistwick School of Musicraft, reads the letter that bears her own signature at the bottom. She takes her time until the other maestros start to fidget. Wink hums and licks his paw. Finally, Mrs. LaRue lowers the letter with a long sigh. "Amelia Jones," she says. "Well, this is a development." I look up at her pleadingly. "Can someone please tell me what's going on?" Mrs. LaRue stands up and circles her desk. She folds her arms, my letter pinched between her fingers, and studies me like I'm a dog that sat up and asked her for the weekly forecast. "Miss Jones, I'm sure you understand that each year we audition thousands of students all over the world." I nod. Will she just get to the point? "Because we see so many children, it's inevitable that we usually see several with the same name." I suck in a breath, as the floor seems to fall out from under me. I understand at once what she means. That letter was never mine at all. This was all a huge mistake, because I'm the wrong Amelia Jones. Chapter 7. The World Tuned Upside Down. The room seems to spin. I concentrate very hard on not throwing up on the headmaestro's expensive-looking shoes. "Perhaps I ought to explain further," she says. "You see, a young lady, also by the name of Amelia Jones, a remarkable pianist of uncommon skill, entered our Los Angeles auditions 2 months ago. Then, a few weeks later, she embarked on a yachting trip with her parents in the Maldives. Tragically, a storm capsized their boat, and everyone on board was lost." "Oh," I say in a very small voice, "that's terrible. That poor girl." For a moment, I forget all my worries, and instead imagine this other Amelia Jones, terrified for her life as waves crash all around. While I was worrying about my audition, she was drowning. "This occurred the same day the Mistwick acceptance letters were sent out via a finding spell," Mrs. LaRue explains. "And I imagine when this letter," she waves the paper that I've treasured like gold, "was unable to find Miss Jones, the other Miss Jones, it found you instead." "A terrible misunderstanding," says Miss Nurani, "made possible only by the most extreme of circumstances." I don't know what to say. I can hardly think straight, but I know what this means. I'm only here by accident. I was never supposed to be here at all. I should have known. I should have seen this coming a million miles away. After the audition I had, why would they want me? My face flushes with embarrassment that I had ever imagined I might be good enough for this place. All those years devoted to a single dream, only to have it taken away from me twice in one summer. First, the disastrous audition, now this. I can't even begin to think about how I'll tell Gran. But then, my heart skips a beat, and I curl my hands into fists. Why should I have to tell her anything at all? Why should I have to go home? I came all this way, and I know I can be good enough. Maybe not now, but if they just let me try, I could get better. I could be what they want me to be. I could do or become anything if it meant being a part of Mistwick. This is the first time in my life that I've felt this close to my mother. It's like her presence is here, in the walls and in the trees and in the light glittering on the lake. This was the place she loved best. And if there's anywhere in the world I will discover more about who she was and who I am, it has to be here. I look the headmaestro in the eye. "If the other Amelia Jones isn't coming," I say, "then that means there's an available spot." In the silence which follows, Mrs. LaRue winces.
Well, says Miss Nurani, hastily stepping in, that's true, but that spot is technically for a pianist, not a flutist. And besides, there is a waiting list.
And you're not exactly at the top of that list,
grunts Mr. Pinwhistle.
His hand goes to his mustache. I remember your audition, young lady. And I don't remember many auditions. Disastrous. One of the worst I've seen.
I swallow hard. I can do better, I promise. Just give me a shot. I'll prove I'm good enough.
That's not how it works,
he replies.
Mistwick has a reputation for finding the very best, most talented young musicians in the world, and you are not—
Mr. Pinwhistle, that will do, Miss Nurani cuts in. Amelia, I'm sorry, but this is out of our control. I start to feel tears, but I blink them away. I will not cry in front of them. I won't let them think I'm a pathetic crybaby, in addition to being the worst audition they've ever seen. Aren't you all in charge of this school? Why can't you just let me try? This school has traditions that have been here far longer than us, says Mrs. LaRue in a stern voice. It has functions we cannot control.
Such as those annoying humfrogs in the lake,
says Mr. Walters.
And the squeaky doorknob in my office that's always spelling itself shut and locking me in,
grumbles Mr. Pinwhistle.
And the echo trees,
adds Miss Becker.
And the order in which students are granted acceptance to the school,
finishes Mrs. LaRue. Something niggles at me. I frown, looking out the window at the forest. The echo trees. Is that what they're called? Miss Nurani arches her eyebrows.
You've seen them?
I heard them too, I say sadly. They're like living music. We played canon together. The maestros all stare at me. Mrs. LaRue presses her hand to her lips.
You played a spell with the echo trees?
She asks in a very soft voice. I shrug. They asked me to, or someone did. I heard a voice telling me to play for them, so I did. I'm sorry if I wasn't supposed to. I'm not really sorry, though. If that's to be my only good memory of this place, then I'm not sorry at all. Maybe I'll sneak back there and play again. What can they do, kick me out twice? All the maestros are looking at me like I just admitted to some terrible crime. I didn't hurt anything, did I? It was just a little music.
To be clear, says Miss Nurani, you played Pachelbel's Canon in D at the edge of the Echo Wood?
I said I'm sorry, I mumble. They look at each other, then back at me. Then Mr. Walter says,
do you think?
And Miss Nurani replies, we have to check. I look at each of them, confused. What did I do? But it's like no one hears me. They turn to each other instead.
This is completely unforeseen,
Mr. Pinwhistle says.
The whole situation, it's unprecedented.
Yes, replies Miss Nurani, but this is a school of musicraft. Our mix-ups generally do have odd and unpredictable consequences.
I guess I'm the odd and unpredictable consequence she means.
Well, we'd better see what the damage is, sighs Mrs. LaRue.
Mr. Pinwhistle, Mr. Walters, and Miss Becker excuse themselves in order to get back to the other students, after making Miss Nurani promise to fill them in later. Fill them in on what, I want to ask. Miss Nurani and Mrs. LaRue lead me out of the office and down the stairs. We stop at another door, this one locked tight. Mrs. LaRue opens it with a large key, and then we're walking onto the grass behind the school, near the amphitheater I saw earlier. Ahead, the Echo Wood waits in silence and darkness. The air is much chillier than it was when the Zeppelin arrived, and I shiver despite my jacket. I don't understand what's wrong, I say. I didn't mean to.
Hush now,
orders Mrs. LaRue.
We will see what we will see. Miss Nurani?
Miss Nurani nods and holds up her viola, striking a quick tune that produces three bobbing spheres of blue light. One hovers over each of our heads, lighting the grass around us as we walk. When we reach the edge of the trees, the maestros begin looking all around. They walk this way and that,
illuminated by their glowing blue light balls, while I stand there like a dummy with no idea what they're doing. I hug my flute case and wait, tapping one foot. Whenever I move, my little light moves with me, casting dancing shadows all around. Overhead, a gentle breeze curls through the canopy, and the faint music hums and then fades, like violins testing their strings before falling silent. A brief dusting of magic lights the trees before dissipating. Then Miss Nurani shouts, "Here!" Mrs. LaRue and I hurry over to where Miss Nurani is pointing at something on the ground. I don't see it until I step around her, and then I gasp. "Recognize this?" she asks me. I nod, unable to believe my eyes. "That's my audition tree." Bent sideways, I'd recognize it anywhere. It's a little taller than it was 6 weeks ago, yet it's just as crooked, stuck forever in a low bough. But it looks healthy, even if it is shaped funny. It has more leaves now, and they're green and glossy, shining in the blue light suspended over us. The soil around it is fresh and damp, like it was just planted there. "It's an echo tree?" I ask. "Yes," replies Miss Nurani. "Echo trees are special. They thrive on music. But most important of all," adds Mrs. LaRue, "they protect the school and everyone inside. You see, their natural music is canon, a summoning spell. Many people think Pachelbel composed it, but really, he only recorded it after discovering a grove of these trees. And when you change a summoning spell to a parallel key, in this case D major to D minor, it reverses and becomes a repelling spell," I whisper. "The trees change key?" "Yes. The moment any unwanted visitor sets foot in the forest, they're repelled." She reaches out and puts her hand against one of the bigger trees, smiling up at it. "Better than any electric security system." She says electric like it's an affront to magic. "So, how did my tree end up here?"
"You put it there yourself."
She points to a building I'd not noticed before, a large greenhouse that reflects the moonlight. We walk over to it and find the door hanging open. Inside are rows and rows of shelves, and on the shelves are a lot of small pots, each holding a little echo tree. I notice right away that most of them are very straight and perfect, the way little echo trees ought to look. Not at all like mine. Miss Nurani hunts down the shelves until she finds an empty spot.
"Here it sat," she said, "until you played the tree's summoning spell. Then it would have flown out and planted itself with the other trees."
"Tomorrow," says Mrs. LaRue, "we will hold a grand planting ceremony in which all the new students will add their trees to the echo wood."
Miss Nurani nods.
"Every tree in the forest represents a student of Mistwick. Most of them long since graduated."
"So, somewhere in this forest is a tree planted by my mom." "What about the rest of these little trees?" I ask. "There are a lot more than 100 here."
"Well, we never throw them out until we're certain who will be in our new class. There are often a few dropouts just before the term begins. That's why we don't send rejection letters till next week."
"Which is why I never got one," I mutter. "Well, unless you're going to rip up my tree, I guess at least a part of me will always be here. That's something anyway." The maestros exchange a long look, and then Miss Nurani takes my hand in hers.
"Amelia," she says softly, "I don't think you understand."
"Understand what?" "I know I have to go home." She shakes her head.
"Like we said earlier, not everything in this school is ours to control. By planting your tree in the Echo Wood, you've come under the forest's protection. If you leave the school now, your tree will wilt, and the protective barrier around the campus will weaken, making everyone inside vulnerable. There are only two ways to safely leave Mistwick for good: by graduating, or by being expelled, either because you chose to drop out or because you broke enough rules."
Mrs. LaRue nods.
"And expulsion is a difficult process. It takes an entire orchestra of maestros playing very complicated and taxing spells to forcefully remove a tree from the wood. We only do it when absolutely necessary, for it causes a great deal of strain on both us and the forest.
I lick my lips, my heart seeming to stand still. So, what are you saying?
I'm saying, Amelia Jones, that accident or no, you're a part of Mistwick now, and you're not going anywhere.
I'm not? I suddenly feel lighter than air, like I could float right up into the sky.
At least not yet, Mrs. LaRue adds, and my stomach sinks a little. I will make a deal with you, Miss Jones. I will give you 2 months, in which you will participate in all your classes and activities as if you were a normal student. And at the end of those 2 months, if you pass an exam I myself will administer, then you will be allowed to stay on, for good. But fail that exam, and you will be expelled, so that another, worthier student might have your place.
She exchanges a look with Miss Nurani, who nods in agreement.
Well, Mrs. LaRue says, extending one elegant hand toward me. Do we have a deal?
I stare at her hand a moment, but I already know I don't have to think twice about my answer. If it's a perfect musician they want, then it's a perfect musician they'll get. I shake the headmaestro's hand.
Chapter 8. Requiem for a Roommate. The girls' dorm is a long, timber-frame building overlooking the lake, with a wide front porch lined with rocking chairs. Miss Nurani escorts me there, where all the other seventh-grade girls are settling into their rooms. We stop outside the door, and I can hear giggling and shouting inside.
If you need anything, ask for Phoebe. She's your senior captain.
Miss Nurani gives me a black bag.
I found a uniform and shoes that ought to fit, and here is your room key. Oh, and the cafeteria will send over a sack dinner for you soon, since you missed the evening meal. Good luck, dear.
She hands me a little wooden whistle with 3 holes in it. It's the oddest-looking key I've ever seen. Drawing a deep breath, I head into the dorm. At least the maestros are keeping this between me and them. The other students never have to know that I accidentally got accepted into Mistwick. I just have to blend in for the next 2 months, focus on my studies, and all of this will blow over. This may have all started as a big mistake, but I can fix it if I can just stop being the Amelia who screwed up her audition and instead become someone better, more talented, more disciplined, more like the other students. I'll practice every single hour of the day. I won't miss any classes. I'll do every extra credit assignment. I am not going to give them a single reason to expel me. From here on, Amelia Jones will be known as the perfect student. Inside the dorm, I find a scene of chaos. Girls running up and down the hallway, dragging suitcases, yelling for dibs on showers. Quietly, I take my key and go from door to door, listening to the others squeal when they find the doors their whistles open. Victoria and Amari discover their roommates and immediately start planning how they'll decorate their room. An older, blonde girl, who must be Phoebe, sees me standing in the hallway like a dummy, my eyes wide and probably looking totally overwhelmed. She looks pretty worn out herself, her cheeks flushed and her ponytail half fallen down.
"What's your name, Guppy?"
she asks in a tired Australian accent.
"Amelia," I say, my voice little more than a squeak under all the noise.
"Amelia Jones."
"Right, then you're down at the end in the..."
"What did you say?" hisses a voice right behind me. I turn around and see a girl standing there, wearing a blue dress, her black silky hair cut to her shoulders, framing her dark eyes and narrow face. I start. The girl's hand darts out and grabs my shoulder.
"What did you say your name was?"
I swallow hard, not sure why my stomach suddenly feels like it's flooded with scrambling mice. "My name is Amelia. Amelia Jones." The girl sucks in a breath, and her eyes suddenly fill with tears. Bewildered, I step back, bumping into Phoebe.
Hey,
Phoebe says, staring in shock at the girl. Come on now, no tears on day one. Little early to be homesick, don't you think?
I thought...
The girl's face is very pale. When I heard that name, I thought it was... With that, she turns and runs out of the dorm altogether, pushing through the other girls. Phoebe sighs.
What the heck was that about?
Another student answers, one of the ones the girl pushed on her way out. I remember this one from our Zeppelin, and because her name alliterates, Claudia the clarinetist from Canada. That was Darby, she says. I didn't think she'd still come to school, not after what happened to Amelia Jones. What? I whisper. Everyone at dinner was talking about it, says Claudia. She and Darby were best friends. They used to go to the same music craft camp as me, and they were always together.
Oh, right, Phoebe says. I heard about that girl. She was some kind of piano prodigy. Real sad story.
Immediately, I feel sorry for the girl in the blue dress. I can't imagine what it would be like to lose your best friend, and only a month ago. They were supposed to come here together. No wonder she looked at me like I was a ghost. I groan and rub my face. So, Phoebe pats my shoulder awkwardly.
Two Amelia Joneses. Weird coincidence. You all right then?
Yeah. I look down at my shoes, feeling like a total fraud. Maybe it's not my fault, but it is true that if she hadn't died, I wouldn't even be here at all. As far as any of the other kids know, I got here the same way the rest of them did, by being a good musician. Though Claudia is giving me a suspicious look. I quickly turn away, before she can see the guilt in my eyes. Phoebe shows me my room, which is at the end of the hall, the door shut. There are two silver nameplates nailed to it, one blank, the other with the name Hamako Bradshaw. Leaving me to it, Phoebe goes to check on the crying girl. Taking a deep breath, I raise the whistle to my lips and blow, covering each hole in slow succession the way I've seen the other girls do, producing three smooth notes, C, E, E-flat. It's a haunting little tune, but I hear a click and look up to see the door creaking open in response. And on the blank nameplate, letters materialize. Amelia Jones. I look at my own name uneasily and wonder if it even is my own name. Or was this room also meant for the other Amelia? Am I just inheriting an entire life that was never supposed to be mine, from a spot at this school to the pillow I'll sleep on? With a little shiver, I step inside and look around. The space is long and narrow, with a bed on either wall and a desk at each end. A sign on the wall reads, "Practice in designated rooms only, no music in the dorms." Noting an old scorch mark on the ceiling, I wonder how many people set fires or unleashed floods in their room before they had to make that rule. My duffel bag is waiting on the floor. Beside it sits a suitcase, expensive, black, and polished, along with two instrument cases, one for an oboe and another I don't recognize. Snooping outright, I peek inside and see a kind of wooden flute. Some students, I learned on the Zeppelin, bring secondary instruments that they get special tutoring with. Whoever Hamako is, she's clearly very talented. I run my hands over the desks, feeling the grooves and dents from generations of students bearing down too hard with their pencils. Opening the bag Miss March gave me, I take out my very own Mistwick uniform. I unfold the sweater vest with the school crest on the front. It's just like the one my mom was wearing in her graduation picture. Holding it now, I can almost feel her standing behind me. Which room was hers? Did she have a view of the forest or the lake? What if she even had this room? I stand up and go to the window, staring at the water, beginning to smile. Maybe I didn't get here the same way as everyone else, but I'm here. All I have to do is prove I deserve to stay.
You've got to be kidding me, says a voice.
I whirl around, startled. The girl from the hallway, Darby, is standing in the doorway, her gaze boring into me and her whistle key glinting in her hand. Her eyes are still red from crying.
Hello, I say. I'm not sure you got the right room. She jabs her finger at Hamako Bradshaw's nameplate.
Darby's my middle name. So, you're the replacement then?
My heart jumps into my throat. What? How does she know my secret already? Am I that guilty looking?
My replacement roommate, she says flatly. Since my original one died.
Oh, I say weakly, only a little relieved. I guess so. So I didn't just take the other Amelia's dorm room. I inherited her roommate, too.
Chapter 9, A Perfect Harmony. I'm awoken in the middle of the night by a blast of trumpets. Startled, I jolt out of my narrow dorm bed and fall to the floor, tangled in my blanket, eyes gritty with sleep.
What the heck?
Groans Darby. It's pitch black outside, and the only light comes from Darby's alarm clock, which reads 5:30 a.m. In its green glow, I can make out her vague form as she sits up.
It sounds like a marching band, I say. Or a marching orchestra?
She just grunts. I stumble to the window and see a group of people standing on the grass by the lake, lit by the blue light curling up from their instruments. Fog drifts on the surface of the water, and the moon is low behind the trees, full and shining. It's the maestros. Not just the four I met at auditions, but a whole orchestra of them. Probably all the teachers in the school. Their illusion spell sends fireworks zinging into the air, where they burst with big, colorful pops. The music is loud and robust, a crashing cacophony of notes that quickens my pulse and startles the sleep from my eyes. Trombones and trumpets and strings, cymbals and tubas, a man with a huge bass drum that sends deep rolling booms across the grounds. Even the cellists and bassists walk along, their instruments in harnesses against their chests. I press my hand to the window and feel the vibrations of each resounding beat, shivering up my arms and echoing in my ribcage. I turn back to Darby. What in the world? A pounding on our door makes us both jump. Before we can move, it's thrown open and Phoebe fills the doorway, clutching her clarinet case.
Grab your instruments, guppies, she shouts around the reed jammed between her lips. You have 30 seconds to meet us outside.
What? Darby gropes for her oboe case. But
move,
bellows Phoebe. Then she's gone, banging on Amari and Victoria's door. We don't even have time to change. I trip over Darby's flute case and knock it over, and she yelps and grabs it, glaring at me. That's a family heirloom, she snaps, as she tucks it safely under her bed. My great-grandfather played this shakuhachi.
I'm sorry. She pushes past me, muttering under her breath in Japanese. Bleary and stumbling, Darby and I make our way down the hallway with dozens of other bewildered, pajama-clad seventh-grade girls. I bump into one lugging a cello and mumble an apology.
This is ridiculous, says Claudia, the clarinetist. Our first orientation class isn't until 9. This is inhumane.
Your breath is inhumane, Hannah retorts, wrinkling her nose.
Point it in another direction, please.
Claudia glares at her.
Wasn't there supposed to be some sort of ceremony this morning?
Asks Rabia. The planting ceremony, I say, remembering that the head maestro had mentioned it. Outside, we see the boys coming from their dorm across campus, just as confused as we are. Some of them aren't even wearing shirts, hugging themselves in the cold air. Their dorm captains lead the way with flashlights. I spot Jai and wave, and he waves back excitedly. His matching pajamas have music notes all over them. The light from the maestro's fireworks illuminates his face. Blue, then red, then green. The maestros start marching across the lawn, still playing their spell, while we students look at each other, shrug, and fall in line behind them. Fireworks pop and crackle above us, reflecting off the windows of the buildings. The dorm captains herd any slow students into line and help the double bassists and tubists with their heavy cases. We walk for a few minutes in the dark,
until we finally come to the Echo Wood and the amphitheater behind Harmony Hall. The greenhouse is behind us. Everything is dim and foggy, but the sky is faintly gray now. It'll be morning soon. The maestros gather on the stage, while the captains sort us into roughly equal groups. Strings, percussion, woodwind, and brass. Some instruments are already set up and waiting for their students. The pianos, drums, xylophones, and other large pieces. I find myself sitting between Claudia with her clarinet and Darby with her oboe. Then my attention is drawn away by the maestros, who finish their spell with a mighty crescendo, sending up a dizzying spray of fireworks. We all stand up and cheer as the sparks dance and fade around us. Only Darby stands in silence, her face flat. Miss Nurani then plays a soft melody on her viola. And behind us, a long row of fire suddenly shoots from a curved channel behind the bleachers, just a foot away from me. Several students cry out, startled, but the fire doesn't give off heat. I hold a hand into the flames, watching them lick my palm. The fire illusion smells sweet, like vanilla. "What are you doing?" Claudia hisses. I withdraw my hand, showing her that it's unharmed. It's just an illusion, not real fire. The flames illuminate Mrs. LaRue as she steps forward. She is dressed in a long burgundy gown, her lips painted to match. Her hair is twisted into a bun and spiked with long feathers, and gold earrings brush her shoulders. Her music hat, Wink, is at her side, licking his paw and watching us with glowing yellow eyes. Miss Nurani finishes her spell and lowers the viola. "Students of Mistwick," begins Mrs. LaRue in her deep, soothing voice. Firelight glints on her earrings and the rings of her fingers. "From all over the world you have come, bringing your own unique music to add to our symphony. We hope you will come to think of this place as a home." There are tears in my eyes. I brush them away before anyone can see. Stupid, crying at some rehearsed speech, I know. But I think of my mother standing here years ago, hearing this same speech under these same trees, and something in me crumbles. I've never felt this close to her since she died. Ever since I went to live with Gran, it's like I've been searching for some way to reach Mom, and now, for the first time, I feel like she's here. It's almost as if she's standing right beside me now, as if I could reach out and touch her. I may have gotten here by accident, but I'm going to fight to stay. I'm going to fight like I never have before. Miss Becker begins a tight drum roll, which ends when another maestro clashes a pair of cymbals together. Then Mrs. LaRue raises her hands. "Welcome, arrows!" She gestures to us woodwind instruments, and the kids around me let out whistles. I join in, following their lead. "Welcome, percussos!" The percussionists stomp their feet in a thunderous roar, and when Mrs. LaRue calls on them, the cordos, Jai's group of string instruments, make a buzzing sound. And the brass players, or librosos, give loud whoops like a gang of monkeys until the rest of us roll our eyes and shout at them to shut up. "These are the four classes that comprise our student body," Mrs. LaRue says, smiling as we settle down. "And your classmates are your brothers and sisters. There will be times when magic demands everything from you. It is then you will look to each other for strength. For as the fourth rule of music craft states," she holds out a hand to us expectantly. In unison, we say, "The more who join into the spell, the greater will its power swell." She nods. "We, your maestros, are here to guide you. But it is the students on your right and your left who will be your support and strength. The friendships you forge at Mistwick will endure for the rest of your lives." I glance at Darby. She stares hard at Mrs. LaRue. The headmaestro gestures to Miss Nurani and Mr. Pinwhistle and the others, who step forward and ready their instruments. "The great echo trees behind me represent every student who has gone before you, as well as your teachers here at the school.
And now, you'll add your own trees to the forest. Join together in a rendition of Canon in D major, and think of your own echo trees taking root in the wood, making you forever a part of this place and the Mistwick family.
She flicks a hand, a conducting baton appearing from her sleeve. Everyone scrambles to take out their instruments, quickly tuning up. No one has told me whether or not I should play, given that my tree is already planted. I hold my flute uncertainly, face warming, until I hear a soft cough behind me.
Turning, I see Miss March, the lady who met our Zeppelin last night.
You too, Amelia, she says. This spell is for all who have a place in the Echo Wood. And you are part of its music now, too.
I smile and nod, and try to believe her. Finally, Mrs. LaRue nods to Miss Nurani, who raises her viola and draws her bow over the strings. The 8 solemn notes of canon sound out, rich tones made eerie by the darkness. Then Mrs. LaRue turns and motions for us to join in. One by one, the other kids slip into the spell. I wait a few breaths, then add my flute's silver tones to the rest. We've never played together before, and I think most of us had never even met each other till yesterday. But Canon in D is one of the most basic of summoning spells, so we make it work with Mrs. LaRue guiding us along. Though she isn't playing an instrument herself, as conductor, she is the heart of the spell, knitting all our magic threads into a whole, making sure we play together. Conducting is an entire skill unto itself, and not many musicians have it. I manage to keep up, but I start noticing the other flutists begin to thread complicated runs and trills into the spell. Watching them, I start to get nervous. I told the maestros I could prove I belonged here, but that was before I realized how good the other students are. Some, like me, follow Miss Nurani with the melody, but many break away to add their own harmonies and counter-melodies, showing off their dexterity and creativity. Several of the strings players lift their bows and instead pluck notes or tap rhythms. The pianists make use of the full range of their keys. A few students go high and sweet, jumping octaves, while those with bass instruments provide a deep, resonating foundation. No showy trills from me. I won't be the one who ruined the entire planting ceremony by getting my fingers all twisted up. I'm not even sure I could manage some of the gymnastics the other flutists are doing with their fingers. So I focus on Mrs. LaRue's baton, following the simple melody. And if anyone gets too creative, Mrs. LaRue reins them in with a look and a small, disapproving tilt of her chin. Somehow, she keeps everyone under control and in sync. And though we sound a bit messy at first, the spell begins to even out as each of us finds our place and tempo. Then, it's as if everything clicks and our individual spells merge into one. All our instruments weave and blend together until goosebumps run down my arms at the beauty and immensity of the combined sounds. The melody is every spell's heart, giving the magic structure and direction. It's the most important part of any piece. But beneath the melody are harmonies, adding strength to the spell. One flute playing alone might move a branch, but a 5-piece ensemble might move a tree. A full orchestra of maestros could move a forest. It isn't long before the spell begins to work, and magic rises all around us. I've never played with an orchestra this big. Just the small music craft classes back at my old school. So I'm not prepared for the brilliance of the light that springs from our instruments. It's like watching a fireworks display. No, scratch that. It's like being a fireworks display. In golden curls and yellow spirals and twisting threads, the magic rises, shimmering before fading into the air. From the students who add complicated scales and arpeggios to the harmony, the lights peel away in tight, curly strands. From the slower notes, like the ones my flute is producing, they rise in smooth streams. The percussionists give off bursts of color,
crackling balls of light that dance over our heads. Wisps of magic curl around Mrs. LaRue's baton and hover at her shoulders like curious butterflies. I've never seen anything this beautiful. It makes my chest ache. And to top it off, the sun begins to rise behind us, its fiery glow spreading across the forest canopy. Sensing movement above, I look up and see little pots floating overhead. The echo trees. As if suspended on invisible strings, they glide through the air and dip to the ground behind Mrs. LaRue and the other maestros, who are playing along with us. There's one for each student, summoned by their music. They pop out of their pots and burrow into the earth. I manage to spot my little tree. It's not hard to recognize, as it's the only one jutting at a right angle halfway up. Quickly, I look away, as if someone might guess that the crooked tree is mine. My cheeks warm with embarrassment at how ridiculous it looks alongside all the others. But at least it's there. And right now, it's the only reason I'm standing here. This has to be the most incredible thing I've ever seen. Over 100 individual summoning spells being woven together in one great protective ward, like many threads woven into one fabric. At last, the spell reaches its end, and Mrs. LaRue drops her hands, signaling for us to lower our instruments. Only in the silence that follows do we hear the echo trees singing, faint and mellow, that sound like instruments being tuned. For a minute, we all listen in awe. I hear a loud sniffle and glance aside to see Darby with tears in her eyes. "Hey," I whisper, reaching out to touch her shoulder. "Are you okay?" She gives me a scowl and pulls away, and I grimace, remembering that even looking at me probably reminds her of her, Amelia. I've got to be the last person in the world who could make her feel better. "Musicians," says Mrs. LaRue, raising both hands toward us. "Welcome to Mistwick." We walk back to the dorms through a thin layer of fog as the rising sun chases away the morning chill. The maestros have disappeared. Our captains walk together, flirting and laughing with each other. A couple kids start calling dibs on showers. Then Phoebe whistles sharply. We all gather around her and the other seniors. They're grinning, and not in a nice way, more like a hungry, sneaky way that immediately puts me on my guard. "Listen up, guppies," she says. "Now that the boring stuff is over, it's time to really initiate you into the Mistwick family. This part is fully optional, but you should know..." She drops her voice so we all have to crane to hear her. "Every student who wimped out in the past eventually met a grisly death." Someone in the back gives a frightened squeak. Claudia rolls her eyes. "That's a lie." "Is it?" Phoebe looks straight at her, eyes narrowing, and Claudia pales.
"What are we supposed to do?"
asks Jai eagerly. Phoebe grins. She holds out a finger and points it like she's playing Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Mo. In a sing-song voice, she says, "You have to face your deepest fears, unearth your darkest secrets, and..." Her finger lands on me. She tilts her head. "Can you swim, Shorty?" I blink. "What? Yeah, but why..." She suddenly bursts forward, throws me over her shoulder, and then runs down the hill toward the lake. I'm so startled I can't even struggle. As I bounce on Phoebe's shoulder, I gape at the other students. Without slowing, Phoebe pounds across a little dock, skids to a halt, then shouts, "Welcome to Mistwick, guppy!" Then she pulls my flute case out of my hands and tosses me into the lake. I hit with a splash, and that water is cold. It closes over my head and pulls me under. Sinking in a cloud of bubbles, I feel a sudden burst of panic in my chest. My muscles seize up, and my lungs squeeze tight like the water is electrified. The deeper I sink, the darker it gets, until I can't even see my own hands. A strange memory takes hold of me. Dark water. My hands. Too small, the hands of a child. Reaching for something I can't quite grasp.
A swift current sweeps me down, down into black, murky depths. It's a memory I didn't even know I had. And now, it fills me with fear and panic and desperation. As I claw my way upward, my lungs squeeze and my head reels. I know how to swim, but I still feel like I'm drowning. Like the water has got me in its teeth and it's not going to let go. I fight against it, a scream locked in my mind. Then, finally, I break through the surface, sucking down air and finding myself in a beam of sunlight. The dark memory fades away. Gasping.